Hey everybody, we're back at the sports medicine broadcast. This is the way that Jeremy Jackson says it. Sports.
We're going three,
two. Oh yeah, hang on. One. Three.
What's up,
two,
welcome
one.
To the sports.
You're reading my script.
Well,
three,
mean,
two, one. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the sports medicine broadcast. I'm Dr. Josh Yellen with the University of Houston Master of Athletic Training Program. To my left is Dr. Cottrell. I said that right.
It's great.
Thank you. And immediately. In front of me is
Sean
Reedy, the Sean, and over to my right is Jeremy Jackson. Okay, Dr. Cottrell, talk to us a little bit about what you do for Memorial Hermann and what your background is. Let's start there first.
Oh, how long do we have?
You have about 30 seconds.
Okay, well, my role is the Director of Human Performance at the Ironman Sports Medicine Institute. I oversee all the human performance programming at our five Ironmans, plus I oversee sports education at our partner, Athlete Training and Health.
Uh-huh.
In that role, I oversee the conditioning staff, dietitians, testing physiologists, biomedical athletic trainers. We do return to play, we do sport performance programming, we do anybody training, we do employee wellness. We do tactical and SWAT team training. You name it, we do it all.
So anything that has to do, he did.
He
did really. And he, by the way, he
but
did
I didn't
in
give
one
any
breath.
Background. I didn't.
He did in one breath.
One breath.
And I didn't do
He's
my
got
background.
A very large. VO2 max.
Yeah, we do still have the background to go with.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. You haven't been breathing yet, have you?
I'm good.
Okay, so tell us about your educational background.
Educational background. So I did my undergraduate in kinesiology at University of Waterloo in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada, if you know where that is. Fine and esteemed program. And then I went on and did my master's degree at Northern Arizona University in exercise science and strength conditioning coach. I went on to a PhD in physiological sciences at Arizona. And I did a postdoc in physiological sciences at Queen's University. Then I moved on to a faculty position as a professor at Sheridan College. And there I was a program coordinator for the athletic therapy degree program. And then I created
this
a new
was
degree.
Where in Canada?
In Canada, Brampton, Ontario, Canada. Created a new degree in kinesiology and health promotion, which I chaired for down here.
It's pretty impressive. And how many publications do you have after now?
Publications? Oh, not many. 15. Yeah. 15 publications. Yeah. So in my role as a professor, it was a teaching institute. So you could do research. They loved it if you did research, but you weren't required to do. So
how
we did
that?
A paper a year. It's pretty easy looking.
Yeah. Yeah. I have myself and our clinical coordinator, Dr. Mark Knobloch, and Mark's PhD is in exercise science from University, and his postdoc is at Baylor College. But he's everything about muscle physiology. I think the two of you sit in the corner.
All
right, so
I'm transitioning.
In your presentation, you talked about like you really controlled the room, and I was talking to I love that you had everybody line up. You had like four lines of five or whatever it was, and you said, okay, at the same time everybody's doing, because you were teaching movement, right? Yellen was talking about educational leadership, and I when I'm teaching CPR, I do the same thing. All the mannequins are facing the same way. We're all doing the same thing. Talk a little bit about why you choose to do it that way and how that really.
Well, it's crowd control, really, right? It's crowd and quality control. Again, the model I was trying to demonstrate today is how do you teach a large group of individuals how to do a certain physical movement?
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, it was catered towards a large group of high school or middle school people, which if you leave them at their own devices, it will get really hairy really quickly. The only way you can control movement skill in that environment with that many people and at the same time keep your eye on everybody is to have them coordinate each other using a tempo or using a command structure. That way I can look down the line and in one glance see out of the five people I'm watching, I can quickly see that one or two that are struggling. If they're all just going at their own pace, at their own time, I wouldn't be able to see anything. They would be all moving at different qualities and it would be hard to correct. So you got to use, even when you're training people in the weight room, not like I was doing more of a movement assessment, but when you're training people in the weight room and they're a new group, you have to start with that, even if it's an adult, if it's a large group of 20, or else you're just going to get breakfast.
From my experience, probably where I would base that off of is working out of a in your strength background, where you develop, being able to watch down the line. And so I think a lot of athletic trainers, they don't have that because they're so hands-on with their patient instead mm-hmm. of multiple. Where in actuality, there's a lot of times where we'll have multiple patients. So can you expand on that a little bit more?
I work with a lot of athletic trainers. I have two staff members that oversee our return to play program. And there'll be situations.
One of them is Jamie Chauvin, right?
Yeah, Jamie. You'll be interviewing her later.
Yeah, who's the other one?
Kate Coleman. Mm-hmm. She was helping out. Yeah, so in return to play, the way the program's designed, it's a monthly fee, and people train in small group sessions, mm-hmm. so they have people. So it's a similar thing. Now imagine you have four or five people at different levels and a different injury, and you have to somehow maintain quality. And so in those circumstances, sometimes you don't just go with the tempo, but you do it with, instead of just counting reps, you can only a minute off, even a 20-second 10 thing where you can really push them, observe the three or four, give them recovery, move on. And so there's a lot of different settings we can get that. It's essential that you just not let people say, okay, you're going to do this, you're going to do that, you go over here, you go over there, and you got to have your eyes on everybody. You got to be standing, mm-hmm. in, especially in a clinic, which we do. So you got to figure out in the space, where do you line people up, so you watch them all, how do you control.
So if I were to take your talk and I were to add some real-world application to what your talk was about and what you're talking about now, tell us some takeaways that you would have for some of your coaches, some of your athletes, and some of your friends. What are some key nuggets that they need?
Really simple. The nuts and bolts of my talk are, don't be in a rush with young app. 2 weeks, teach them how to live a lifetime of repayment. Mm-hmm. If you do not take those 2 weeks, your poor technique can never maximize the bar, mm-hmm. and never doing it. Always be compensated, always doing wrong and not used. If you watch any world-level powerlift, and you watch, there's a reason their technique, it's not because if we aren't making our athletes high quality, we're limiting them to really power.
So really, one of the things that we want to do with our young athletes, probably no weight, right? Everybody's so excited to get in the weight room, but let's start moving with body weight. And that seems to be a theme that has come across the table today.
Yeah, it was interesting. After the talk, a fellow came up to me and said, well, you know, is it safe? Walking, going upstairs is lifting weights. There's just different levels of lifting weights. Strength is a push-up or a plank, squat with a dowel on your knee. Mm-hmm. So you can develop really effective without using any weight. I can exhaust this male doing any kind at all, just mm-hmm. boom. And so with young kids, you got to teach them how to use their motion with good movement quality. The strength was there, then you can.
Go ahead. You know what I was going to tell you? When I really started to get good at rehab is when I transitioned from a traditional athletic training clinic setting, and I had the private sector for about 2 years. And that's where I really got good at. I started. This is really how the body, this is how you looks like before after. You've already got that. So I think that anybody, if you are a practicing athletic trainer, going and getting more to see you, more about how the body moves and understand the physiological biomechanical backgrounds. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Only one thing I was going to say there was the aspect that because I was standing there when you were talking about that individual. The one thing that I've seen in athletic trainers, it's in anybody correcting it, and I think so many people want to throw on that weight so quick, or they want to add a different dynamic to it, want to put a person into onto an unstable surface. They want to throw weight onto them. They want to add additional prior to actually creating that fundamental primal movement pattern of like a hip hinge, a lunge, or a step up, or a squat, or a press, prior to actually learning true movement pattern.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So how do you utilize that, and how do you push those with your staff to, hey, you don't have to jump into throwing somebody in a squat. Let's learn to move correctly.
Yeah, you know, we have an education system, and they're online, and we make them just all sit through a little rant today, small snippet, make them sit through the technique so they understand. For some of them, they're going, oh, I kind of see it now, you're going there. And what's interesting is with my staff, most of them do pretty good at a job that I've given them. But then on the flip side of that, sometimes then you get held back too long and corrective, and they never get to that. And with my staff, because now they're really good at correctives, and I think in general, ATs are importance of it. Then when does it come time to start loading instead of just doing kind of wobble board or head?
So talk about that. What are some of the outcomes that you, what kind of criteria?
So obviously, can they perform underbody? One of the biggest limitations we find in our rehab environments, we have these for such a short period of time. We never get them to tolerate the should. Like if you're dealing with the loads occurring on the football field, even in a track house, if you look at elite track house, they're doing single leg 4 meters and stuff like that. It's crazy the power that is with a single leg. Yet we get excited if a kid that we send out like hot for really in reality, that's not important. That as soon as they move well and they have to tolerate that for sets, that you start loading. It doesn't mean throw big weight on, but every workout.
So do you have a certain percentage of progressions that you like to follow?
Percentage load, you mean? Or no, it's there's every individual, depends on what their ability is. What I teach my coaches to do is you can see at the speed of the movement and the confidence watching one rep. And in fact, our coaches, after watching 2 reps of exercise, should know if they're going to actually achieve the reps you're or if you pull the plug on. So you just develop a curve. And that's based off bar velocity. And you've probably heard a lot of velocity-based training. Well, it's great to have a you put on your arm to tell you how fast you're, but really, if you're a good coach, you know after a couple of reps, they're going to get all 6 or 8. Because in reality, in a lot of these situations, you don't need them, you know, struggling up with that fourth and rep. You know, you need quality of control.
So in your mind, you'll terminate reps so that when you start to see them struggle, stop.
Oftentimes, if it's in an earlier rehab phase or a return to play setting where they haven't really loaded much yet, there'll be time later on when you'll have a few cycles where them up like that, but you're still in return to play. You're trying to maximize velocity, you're trying to maximize quality and not put them under. Then once they're back, you're playing ready. Now, okay, let's go through a phase and they'll grind out and then back it off
again. The only thing I think of is I wish like every strength coach in the world had his mindset.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. And the understanding there to from going from a rehab base or a rehab side of things to actually incorporating your GPP type stuff into that type of training, which I don't think enough of us do.
For those that are listening that don't know what GPP.
General Physical Preparedness type training. Sorry, I apologize.
No, don't apologize to me. But we have some audience. Some audience members that don't know what you're talking about.
But adding that aspect into things in your rehab, in your beginning, because not everybody has that actual strength coach or strength movement. How from what you've seen, can people add that? How can athletic trainers add that? How can you kind of guide them to, and how do you guide your staff to not only be focusing on the injury aspect, but on the, hey, this is the long-term goal of what we're going to get
to? Yeah, it's pretty easy, actually, in my mindset. The general physical preparation is quite easy in the return to play setting because initially they can't load. You're worrying about movement quality, yes. They can't load much, so they're usually not that for how long they've been off. And so it's as simple as just doing your supersets, tri-sets, circuits, tempoed sets, and you can develop movement quality. You can get a lot of volume in. You can get a lot of different, and at the same time build. So if you're doing like a squat push pull as one of your tri-sets for your A circuit, and then you give them a little bit of recovery, and go a single leg or a hinge push pull again, or a single leg hinge pull, another pull exercise, and then your C circuit, a little bit of finisher like prowl or a battle rope conditioning circuit. None of that will really heavy. None of that will put them in a situation of grinding reps. Every one of those things will develop a metabolic tolerance to training and at the same time learning a lot. So we do that. Usually our return to play program, all those kinds of common elements. Again, though, the problem is that sometimes the athletic trainer, the therapist, get used to that program because it's fun. It's easy to do. Mm-hmm. It's easy to pull through because it's hard to do that superset. So at some point, you got to flick that switch. Okay, now we're gonna do straight sets, quality squats, and then we'll put a little bit of the more specific now, because by then you're doing sprints, that kind of thing, or focus. Mm-hmm. So that's usually how we allow our program.
See, to me, that's where it starts to get fun.
That's that aspect that you were just talking about, that, you know, we need to get better at bringing those people in by going out and doing the research, looking at learning how to help that strength coach, because even in the college setting, or even especially in the high school setting, but even in the college setting that I was in, you know, you have that window, that gray window of, all right, are they ready for play? Are they ready there? That, you know, we were lucky that we could kind of work them through. But I know that there's a lot of places that they don't have that ability to generate that.
I think one of the biggest dangers that we see is that everybody has the potential to be siloed, and that we have to work really hard to make sure that we're what's called interprofessional, that we're in the same, you know, whenever we're dealing with the patient, client, or athlete, we've got all the healthcare providers at the table. That's going to be obviously it'll always be a physician. Whether it be a physician, an athletic trainer, and a strength coach, a physician, physical therapist, athletic trainer, whoever it is, we're all at the same table and we're all talking, because there are things that he's talking about that maybe I learned at some point in my curriculum, but that's not what I do. And so we have athletic trainers that, like you and I were talking about before this started up, if I have an athletic trainer in a football setting, I look at it as the different setting. Right, so an athletic trainer in a football setting represents emergency. An athletic trainer in another setting may represent primary care. You really represent, you know, human performance and development. So there are aspects that when you're talking, of course, physiologically, academically, what you're doing, but this is what I do every day. So let's make sure that we're talking and communicating, because at some point, I need to know when to hand off to you. Like, okay, go. Oh, and by the way, if I am an athletic trainer in the secondary, we don't have strength coach. The strength coach is probably a football coach that has his degree in history.
Position coach.
This guy played in the NFL for 2 years, and so he must know what he's doing. We'll put him in the weight room, and just because he's squatting, you know, 400 pounds, well, you know, hey, listen, I know you're 14, but throw that 400 pounds on. Let's see what you can do.
And that's funny, because that's exactly what you were just talking about when we were standing in there after your talk, was actually that development. And so in those, I guess, lower level, seventh, sixth, seventh, eighth grade kids, let's talk about how Explain kind of what you were talking about, how you like to develop those. Some kids aren't ready for that. Some kids are.
So he was basically, a fellow was challenging me and said, what age is it okay? As long as they are mature enough and coachable enough, you can start doing resistance training at any time, because it's not really resistance training, it's physical literacy. It's learning how to use your body. So again, a push-up is walking downstairs. It's not in reality. It's a week. And so when we're looking at young kids and ability to progress through, knowing that it's probably a good idea for them, it's just a matter of looking at, are they interested in the weight room, and when the weight room can develop some skills and develop them. What's interesting is with some of them is I have a rule, never give up hope. As some strength coaches say, you'll be surprised, because all of a sudden, I've worked with these young kids, all of a sudden through puberty a switch clicks, and I don't know why. One day, all of a sudden, everything changes, and the things you've been banging on for a year or two, all of a sudden, they get better. I don't know why that switch turns on, but it's
exactly what happened to me. You know, growing up, I was always the smallest. You know, I'd be in the weight room, I'd see all my friends developing, getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and I was a limber, and I would just be in the gym. I could figure out, I just wanted to be 25, and all of a sudden, puberty.
And every day, you got stronger. Every day
You know, by the time I really got done with my power lift, I mean, I was squatting over 500, I was benching over 400. What happened? I don't know. Just one day, I took the bar off the rack, and it managed it. I was on a unicycle.
Yeah, so I'm not sure. Did I answer your question?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's interesting. But if they're in the weight room and they don't want to be there at all, and they can't control themselves, and sometimes there's a limitation there, then, you know, you want to find other things, active and healthy. There's other ways other than just the weight room. The sooner you can get them there moving, the better it'll be. If you wait until they're 18 years old to get them in the weight room, you're really limited in what strength, really. I worked with Olympic wrestling. Most of the athletes I started with barely touched at 1 year old. And it's surprisingly hard in this very strength-dominated to develop a lot of strength, believe it or not, even though they're already in a strength sport. So, whereas I can take a 14... Some 20-year-old wrestlers never ever. So it's kind of interesting.
That's just one of those things that I think that you know, we kind of run into, that, you know, people say, they just say too much, is that we've got, you shouldn't be squatting them, you shouldn't be having them lift weights because they're too young. And that's one of those things that I know Jeremy and I have talked on some different talks. I know Dr. Yellen and I have talked on some different things. But I really like that aspect of getting people moving earlier, because they keep moving earlier and they learn to move earlier.
And it's crazy, that mythology around weight training stunting growth. It's amazing how long that's lasted as a complete myth from the 50s. The hypotheses on which that's based have been disproven many, many times. Yet, you'll hear it if you go into a room of parents and you're talking about the high school strength program you're about to run, and ask them if they've heard that weight training is bad for their kids. And
it'll stunt their growth. Yeah,
you hear it all the time. All the time.
And correct me if I'm wrong, it really came out of, at that point, the growth plates are open, and if we can have some sort of crushing, there was one instance of that, and that's, you know, all of a sudden the legend.
Yeah, that was one of them. Yeah, there's three trains of thought. One was that. One was the, they found that weightlifting increased testosterone, new testosterone caused osteoporosis. Mm. So that was a hypothesis. And the third one was that they, after World War II, they went to a Japanese internment camp, these undersized children. Mm-hmm. These kids were incredibly, they figured it was the heavy growth.
Not the malnutrition.
Not the malnutrition.
Yeah, not the malnutrition, but the heavy
load. Exactly. So those were the three lines, and all three of those lines have since been disproven.
Crazy. One thing we don't have a problem with now.
No, malnutrition.
No,
For the most part.
All right, well, I got to step away because I got to go take a phone call here. But before I go, I wanted to give you my card here.
Okay,
that's
awesome.
Us, the University of Houston.
Yes, I've met you before.
Like, yeah, you have. We're networking.
Yeah, we're networking.
Okay. And so what I want to do is...
I've taught courses for you. Did you know me?
I think I have.
No, I just...
What I want to do is I want to continue this conversation, and I want to try to bring you into our program so you have this conversation. Meantime...
You guys want to keep going?
I'll be back.
All right, good chat. What else you guys got? You have anything interesting to chat about?
So I do. I have a question now. So something else that I heard you talking about, and this is one thing that interests me quite a bit because I teach in a lot of this similar dynamic, is depth of squat. I heard you talking about that, and there are so many people, and I get this comment to me all the time. Oh, well, you shouldn't go below parallel. It's terrible on your knees. It's going to tear up your knees. And I've heard the arguments. I've argued against the arguments for a long time. But what are... Give us your opinion on that, because I actually just heard your opinion.
Yeah, I've got a nice hour and a half lecture just on the squat, if you don't want to hear a fun lecture. But yeah, so whenever someone says, don't squat that deep, it's bad for your knees, the simple response is, oh, really, what part of the knee? And let them explain to you what they think of the part of the knee. And most of them can't tell you. They just have heard somewhere that it's bad for knees. And they'll start saying things like, well, there's shear and meniscus, but they'll never be able to explain to you biomechanically. And the simple follow-up is, well, yes, some would think that during squat, it would cause excessive shears on the knees, which could put at risk. But research has shown that the shear forces acting on the knee squat lift, even under heavy load, is much less than that in jumping and or within tolerable limit structures. And so in reality, the forces on the knee are quite tolerable. If you, research has shown that as you get out of good position, the shear from the knee go up to higher load. Show as you load more, but when you get to a certain amount of load, the compressive forces also go up, which seats the femur condylar ridge and holds that, that in place, which creates shear, right? So, you know, it's pretty easy to have that discussion. They may not. Again, I said in my lecture that 25 years ago, I guess it's been, back in a mentor, Richard Borden was a therapist, he's the dean of the College of Health Profession that had a fit program. We used to go on the Dog and Pony Roadshow and these talks, so upset to hear this. But we always asked them what the knee, and they couldn't tell us. And the only study showing ligamentous risk was that 1901 study by Earl Klein that showed increased knee valgus laxity of weightlifters after they can open. Are you familiar with that study?
Yes.
Yeah. And which he used a completely biased hypothesis, really biased manual test for knee laxity in a person that's just finished an athletic competition and compared it to individuals who weren't even warmed up and found increased laxity in two ligaments that aren't even under stress during LCL and MCL stress during squats. The study was flawed from start to end, but it was carried down weight training to accept it. So what, again, for me, it's like saying, do you not want your elbow to go through when you're doing any kind of, do you not want your range of motion, any kind of throwing out? Do you not want your hip and knee to go through a full range of squatting out? Doesn't mean that everybody absolutely has to go through that motion all the time. Squat, there's some advantage in quarter squats, there's some advantage to doing parallels. There's also a lot of advantage. Teach a person a full squat, below parallel, or even a limb or some low, to develop strength. Like I said, all the time, you have created a good athlete. If you have an athlete who can't do that, they're always going to be limited to something, if ever. You got to make that call. As I told the gentleman, I had an Olympic wrestler that I worked with, phenomenal athlete. He could not straighten his right elbow, could not squat below because of past injuries. He was an Olympic level athlete. I trained around dysfunction and strongness. A saying a friend of mine said, many of phenomenal athletes have been developed through strength, which from an athletic trainer or a clinical, that seems wrong. But if you've ever worked with NFL athletes, very few of them move, right? Have you ever worked with,
yes.
Well, collegiate, if you're at University of Houston, Morgan, some pretty good athletes there. Few of them move very well, yet, through building strength and power on top of that dysfunction, they somehow found it. Doesn't mean that you don't want to correct it. You can't do it. Sometimes you just go with what we have and try and make it as possible.
All right. You talked about how your son is a competitive powerlifter at the age of 10.
Olympic weightlifter. Although he couldn't powerlift.
All right. So my son's at 6 and 4. Like, instead of, you know, like a spanking, just, all right, well, you do push-ups.
Oh.
Or you do dead bugs. Or you do mountain climbers. Those kind
moral
of things.
Moral dilemma there.
Right? And so with those, I mean, you know, my 6-year-old, one of the things I heard you say was if they're mentally competent and aware of their body, they can begin to lift weights. You've actually asked people like 8-year weight room because they're not mentally competent of their body. So am I doing a disservice to my children by having them push-ups at 6 and 4 for you know, discipline? Or is it okay to allow them to kind of do that on their own to see what it feels like?
Well, I think there's two parts to that question. One is exercise, a disciplinary measure. Some psychologists say, well, what you're doing is you're teaching them that exercise is a bad thing. You're disciplining them. You should not look for it. I do that with my kids. I force my kids too. You know,
yeah,
they don't want
to
work out. My son, actually, he's a pretty good weightlifter and he moves really well. But you ask him if he enjoys training. He says, no, I don't. And he's been doing it now. And, well, you know, that's why he trains, right? As do most of us. So, you know, with your kid, are you doing them a disservice? You know, that's a more of a parenting and a psychology question. My question to you is, when the kids do it, do they get excited about doing it? Does their father model it? Do you train in front of them? Do you exercise in front of your kids?
Yeah, I do it at the house. We'll do push-ups. And, you know, I take them up to the weight room. A lot of the times what ends up happening is they're climbing on the equipment while I'm working. They're there with me. And
yeah.
You know, a lot of times I'm like, all right, guys, you know, you got to get your...
Yeah, come here and do that. Yeah, do these two things. So that is, to me, the best way to get young children comfortable with and physical. And my kids, my daughter, one year and a half, I coach in Arizona, and she was in every day when I was coaching in a little car chair at first, and she was toddling. And my daughter from 8 years old has been comfortable. So how many girls are comfortable in a weight room? My daughter now at age of 17 could walk into any weight room anywhere in the, not with machines, with free weights doing clean and jerk. And so I think with young kids, that's what you're trying to develop, this comfort training is good. Something everybody should do. It's easy to do. You've got the power to do it. Now, to me, that gives a lifetime to a kid. And that's one of my big stories today is most of these kids that you're working with, grade 7, 8, they're not going to go on to, but they are going to spend their rest of their life. And if you can teach them how to move well and not injure them, they can spend. But if you don't teach them to move well and you hurt them.
I will say my 2-year-old does say, Daddy, can I do push-ups?
Yeah, exactly.
So, like if one of the older one gets in trouble, then he's saying, can I do them too? Sure, buddy, you can do jump ejection.
Modeling is critical. They got to see the, if you're interested.
I'll go off of that I mean, coming up with my father, probably some of my greatest memories are going back, and probably the reason that I went in the direction that I did was because he liked to move. He liked to be active. In his 70s, he was active. He was moving. He was always doing stuff, and that was kind of something that, like you said, Jeremy, that you have them do, well, I would have them do, or I would do with him, and I think that's probably why I went on and went into a movement profession and went in and really like assessing and like doing and stuff like that. And probably some of my best memories are from that.
That's great, great Bonnie.
Good. All right. So Dr. Cottrell, you know, my brother-in-law is actually the head coach. Houston Baptist University was Rick Cottrell.
I have an uncle. Ron.
It's not the same guy.
It's not the same guy.
All right. So if somebody wants to get a hold of you, find out more.
Oh, geez. So I am the director of human performance at the Ironman Institute. You can go to our website, ironman.memorial.org. My email is trevor.cottrell. Do you want me to spell it out?
Two R's, two L.
You know, something like TREVOR.COTRE. Well, Herman is MEMORIALHERAN.org. So shoot me an email and you
cheated us, man. You didn't spell out the org.
Oh, sorry about that. Sorry. No. Google it.
All right. And then obviously, Dr. Yellen left, but Josh Yellen, Sean Reedy.
Well, I have one question for you. Now, it's more so on the contact. Athletic training and health, correct? Athlete training and health, sorry. Yeah. Follows through with under you, correct, as well?
Yeah, so I oversee the sports science and education training and health, which is a private performance training facility that has, you know, caters to mostly amateur athletics, so high school, but also has college NFL combine, college offseason, NFL offseason, and then it has an adult fitness wellness tactical with SWAT athletes and firefighters.
And I'll just throw out there that I follow them on Instagram and some of the social medias, and I really like some of the stuff that they put out. And,
Athlete Training and Health, ATH. If you do Athlete Training and Health on Twitter, on Instagram. Yeah, they do a pretty good job. We have an education, little 2-minute educational clips without, mostly for parents, but you can see some of the, it'll link you to. I'm on Twitter and Facebook, not that active. You can follow me now.
Very good. Well, I have been thoroughly impressed with not just your knowledge, but your ability to share it. So thank you for what you did here at the Sun Update today here on the podcast.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.